If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Game Dev Unchained, the number one game development podcast about game development and the lifestyle thereof. I am your host, Brandon Pham, and with me, a special guest this week, Jason Lee. How you doing, Jason?
I'm doing good.
Awesome. So this is a part of the podcast where I ask our guest, which is yourself, about yourself, like where you've been, where you at, where you heading, just a little short introduction to our listeners out there.
Yeah. So hello, everybody. My name is Jason Lee. I'm Chief Creative Officer at Pixelmatic. I'm basically in charge of the whole creative direction of the game. So basically how vision is experienced by the player through the perfect combination of gameplay, the art and sound. I've worked in the game development industry for over 15 years. Before joining Pixelmatic, I was at Relic Entertainment, involved in franchises at Company of Heroes, which was one of the highest rated RTS games of all time, and Age of Empires 4. Age of Empires 4 is a huge project being developed by Relic Entertainment and published by Microsoft, taking all things that fans love about Age of Empires and allowing them to experience again as if it was developed in 2020. The team, talk about Pixelmatic. Pixelmatic is a game development studio based in Shanghai with distributed teams all around the world. Most of the creative leadership team is based in Vancouver, BC and Victoria in Canada. The team at Pixelmatic is comprised of many AAA veterans in the game development industry. They come from industries like Relic, Ubisoft, BioWare, Nintendo, and have worked on games like Company of Heroes, Age of Empires 4, Homeworld, Anthem, EVE Online, and more.
Awesome. Well, there's a lot to dig into here. So we're going to go, off tangent once in a while. But the meat of the topic is, of course, what you guys are doing at Pixelmatic and MMO in general. But a few questions that I think to kind of dive deeper into your origin story a bit. So you started in AAA. You spent a good amount of time in AAA. And what I always find interesting is developers that jump around a lot to different parts of the industry. And now you have your own studio. Did you kind of go over how big the team is real quick at Pixelmatic? Just give an idea.
About around 50 to 60 people now. We're growing.
Yeah. Oh, nice. So to kind of compare that to, what you're used to, how big were the teams over at your previous studio?
Yeah, I would say Relic Entertainment is probably a mid-tier level studio compared to a bigger EA, which would be Omega.
Yeah.
But Relic, I would say, I think it's 200 or so altogether. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the questions that I always, because MMO has been a part of game development, game industry for a long time, and it's the name nomenclature itself is called massively multiplayer. All right. What does it stand for MMO again? I always get it mixed up.
Yeah, massive multiplayer.
Yeah, online, right? And it's been kind of weird because the Battle Royale recently has kind of been dominating the charts and kind of took that and then it stretched it a bit because, you know, you're dealing with 100 players now. So how massive really is multiplayer online games now? Is it comparative to that? Or like what is the average number of size of players that you expect in a regular MMO?
I think it really depends on their technical limitations. What defines an MMO is really just that there's a lot of players that can play together in one virtual universe, right? Something that's more than like 4-on-4, because, you know, that can be done. That's not an MMO. Yeah. But, you know, in the scale of like 10 versus 10 or even like 20 versus 20, like 100 people or more, it's hard to say, put an actual number on it, because like if they can do more, that's great. Right. I think that's more of a technical limitations. In our universe, like we're aiming for scenarios where we can have up to like 40, 50 people in one concentrated instance at a time. So yeah, that's quite a lot of people.
Yeah, that's still a lot for sure. Yeah. The reason why I'm following up with this question is because, like, genres have been kind of blurred the last few years. You know, Battle Royale is technically a kind of a MMO type, but then there's a MMO RPG, and it's like just a lot of hybrid type of genres that gets mixed up. And in a way, it, for me at least, it feels like it's hard to kind of label games nowadays and just call it by the title of the game.
The MMO just simply refers to the number of players that has accessibility, that can play together. When you talk about the battle arena style games, their focus is on PvP, where, you know, players are pitted against each other. In a bigger arena sense, kind of like the gladiator pit, games like that are. So that those games are generally labeled MOBAs, which like, that's their term. What Infinite Fleet is trying to do is trying to create a game where, you know, massive amounts of players can play together. And there's whole social dynamic aspect where players can collaborate and help each other out is something that's very important. So that's the reason for the importance of that sort of MMO aspect of things, because we want massive player collaborations and the ability for players to sort of direct the narrative. And that can only be done when there's a huge groups of players that can sort of collaborate with each other, and the game itself is not focused on a sort of solo experience.
Yes. And again, to kind of talk about your time over at Relic, you spent like a good amount of a decade basically over there. What the Switch is always interesting, being a developer myself, because I jumped around too. I started AAA, and at a certain point I wanted to see what indie was like and mobile, and to kind of discover different things. What was your motivation for the Switch to kind of do things on a smaller scale?
Yeah, I mean, I actually didn't switch around. Like, I started at Relic, so I was actually there for a long time.
Yeah.
This was my first move. And it took a while to make this decision. It was sort of always in the back of my mind that I felt like it was sort of the next push in terms of my career that I had to take in order for me as a game developer to sort of grow. When you're working, I don't know if you said you worked in the game development industry before, but I don't know if you've experienced the same thing, but I feel like in a bigger studio, everybody is very specialized, right, in their role. Yeah. And you don't get to really branch out and experience a lot of the different areas of even your own design. I'm a designer, so all the different facets of design that I want to see and sort of grow as a developer. And I also wanted to learn more about the whole scape of, you know, the game development industry as a whole, from, you know, like the financial aspect of things, how things get funded, how you know, the sort of operations and stuff works as well. So, yeah, I wanted to get the whole holistic picture of the game development. So, that, you know, that those are some of the reasons why I made the switch. I felt like I was doing, being where I was for as long as I have, I felt like a machine, just sort of replicating the same thing over and over again. Mm-hmm. And I just had to sort of grow as a person and as a developer. So I had, that's the biggest reason why I made the switch.
Yeah, I think a lot of developers, and I talk to students or listeners that are starting the industry, and there is a glorifying aspect of AAA. It's the light that everybody kind of gets magnetized to when they think about moving and working in the industry, right? And at least that's how I felt, you know, when I was a student in the very beginning, and a good 4-5 years into it, I was like AAA all the way. There's nothing else. But what I often find is talking to veterans such as yourself, it's like there is a wall that you hit as a developer that tends to deteriorate, a facade that you kind of build up for yourself. And I completely agree with you. There is a price to being at the bleeding edge, because a lot of AAA development is about that. It's like you're working with the latest tech, but the truth is, and especially MMOs, there's long dev cycles. Yeah. And like the discoverability of new technology and things are usually the first year. But after that, it's like you said, rinse and repeat for a long time. And like you said, and maybe you can relate to this, I was often finding myself at the bleeding edge, but like kind of falling behind on like innovations, because, you know, I get jealous of the like the smaller teams, the indie developer who's like playing around with new tools like every month because they can incorporate and be flexible. Big machines don't move that way. If you can kind of talk more about that aspect too, kind of like what your own experience, what, and especially in design, like what kind of things, like you were saying, you were being pigeonholed to department of design, and you wanted to really look, you know, at the holistic view of what design has to offer in a game.
Yeah. The thing about bigger studios is they like to play safe, right? Obviously when you have more to lose, you want to risk, you want to take less risk. When I was talking about sort of, being pigeonholed into what I was good at, you know, a lot of what I was good at Relic was sort of systems design, multiplayer design, game balance, in that role. So, I did want to explore more in sort of leadership and more in sort of the high, making decisions more on the higher level end of thing, because I wanted to sort of, I saw issues in certain designs that were at the core of things. And I felt like in some aspects, I didn't have the influence, and I was involved to make those changes. I just had to sort of take that direction and make the best of it, right? So those are things that I just, and maybe I was wrong. If I was more involved, I could have better understood some of those decisions, but I wasn't, right? So I just wanted to be involved and learn more about that. But it's just, like, I understand from Relic as a studio perspective, it's just that, you know, there's this, we have an employee that's amazing at this one area. You know, it's hard to find somebody that is as good. So, you know, why put them somewhere else?
Yeah.
I understand that part from a company investment perspective, but as an employee, as everybody, they want to grow, right? And from a studio perspective, you know, like bigger studios are less prone to sort of take risk and try new things, right? New IPs and new monetization model, you know, new technology, because it hasn't been proven. They have to be the guinea pig, right? Where, you know, the newer studios are trying to make indie games and they're trying to make a name for themselves, right? So they're more willing to make those kind of risks and take those risks and try more of that kind of stuff. So that's also super exciting, being able to participate in the sort of new technology and new ways of doing things, game development or technology or monetization and all of that, to see, you know, how we can sort of innovate the game industry as a whole.
Yeah. And to kind of sign off on that too, one of the biggest trends last, I think, couple of years has been these relatively big teams, big games like an MMO, then finding smaller teams to do it, but more efficiently. And like you said, the comparison, that's why I asked the question before, like a relatively MMO team, usually AAA team, like a first person shooter is like 200-300 and that's high. MMO, like you said, 200-300, it's like mid-size MMO. So usually those teams are even crazier. Now your team is growing from 50 to a little more, but you know, there is a containment that you guys probably don't want to, you know, pass a threshold to kind of keep it, you know, relatively everyone has an opinion type of thing. But like the last couple of years has been that kind of move where we're like, these games that used to be made with bigger teams can be done now with better tools, better efficiency. Can you kind of talk more of that aspect of what you guys are bringing with Infinite Fleet that you feel is, you know, in comparison and more agile than what you were used to making?
Yeah. So one prime example is, I think it was Star Citizen that just said they raised like $10 million to open up a new, I mean, they keep raising money without the game being released, but yeah, they just raised, they have $10 million that they're going to dedicate to opening up a new studio with a whole bunch of people that are just going to focus on building their universe, their world. For us, like, we don't need to do that. The way we're going to build our world is through procedural generation by just creating a specific rule sets for where, how the procedural generation it should execute, right? And that way, we don't need a whole, a $10 million studio just based on creating levels. I think this is a bit overkill, what they're trying to do. So that's like a prime example of what we're doing. Also, like in terms of the way studio and structure is run, it's very different, I guess, like the mindset of a bigger studio, because they have this big chunk of money right from the beginning, saying, hey, you have this money and build this game. So you can holistically plan the development of what that game is and just slowly build things, to reach that goal. Where from an indie or a startup that is trying to raise money while developing, they have to sort of break apart. They need the big picture, but they also have to break apart. What is the core? What is the core of our game that has to be what we like? If we were to release a $2 million game, what would that look like? If that game was now we can make it into a $5 million there, what would that game look like? And sort of look at the MVPs and start and develop the game in that manner, right? Those are some big differences.
Yeah, I think the two biggest things with game developers as part of strengthening our tool shed has been cheating as much as possible and editing. And I feel like you said big budget games are great when you have a ton of money and it feels like creative freedom. But I think the creative freedom kind of creates a problem for a lot of creatives because it just doesn't show any limitation and it's just endlessly long dev cycles and funny enough, not very innovative because they don't want to test the waters too much. It's a weird predicament with that with AAA. It's a weird way. You would think that with the most money that they have the most room to move around, but it's the opposite. And then the indie devs are the one that are being innovative because they have so much risk at hand, and they have to constantly cut away features. And I'm talking to a designer on an MMO, so cutting features is probably the hardest things that discipline has to do versus all other discipline. So I would like to kind of ask you about that more on more on that front, right? When it comes to, you're mentioning, right, a competitor-ish, but feel free not to answer the question how comfortable, you know, Star Citizen, right? Star Citizen has, to me at least, and this is my opinion, been kind of like, it's something I laugh at all the time because they are never shipping that game. And I don't think the fans realize that it is against their wishes to ship that game because they're making money every day, right? And at the same time, it hurts me as a developer because, you know, that was in the heyday of Kickstarter crowdfunding, where you go direct to consumer and it's like a dream come true for a lot of developers. Like, I don't have to cut out the middleman, right? I want to develop a game, and I found the fans that fund it. But I think that trend, and maybe they'll prove us all wrong, Star Citizen is this grandiose game. But I would love to kind of hear your commentary about that, because MMO is very similar to a lot of like game design focused Kickstarter projects, like the board games, you know, analog games made like a huge, huge run. And I feel like that format has kind of been taking a back seat because of all this, I wouldn't say failed crowdfunding, but just longer crowdfunded projects.
So I think the thing is, what I worry about with Star Citizen is there's all these different features and different things going into the game. They're that's why it's not releasing. All these, and the thing is, as a designer, I can relate in that, you know, there's always interesting and creative ideas that come and like, oh, that would be cool. And oh, yeah, that's a great idea. We want players to explore that or experience this, right? But at the end of the day, like, I think like players need to be somewhat led, or else they get lost in your universe and don't know what to do, right? And that's sort of when you start to cut features, like in our, you know, when we need to really focus on what features is important, you know, we have to ask the hard question, like, what is the core experience that we want players to have when they play Infinite Fleet, right? And that has to be developed first and foremost, and really beefed up first and foremost, and everything else is sort of placed on top. And then they sort of accentuate that experience and add to it, right? So it's really, the thing is, like, I think once you have a game and you've built the game with that sort of, with a healthy core experience developed, with some level of further depth, you have to really ask yourself, like, are all these features really necessary, with the original goals that we set in mind, or are we just just adding things just for the sake of adding things because we think it'll be cool, right? And I feel like that's sort of at this point where, you know, Star Citizen is sort of at. I don't think they really need to be developing the game anymore, but yeah.
Yeah, I always joke around that if I can handcuff a producer with a designer in the studio, it solves a lot of the issues, because deadlines are so important for all discipline, especially. And I think for a major undertaking like an MMO, which I feel is still one of the hardest games or genres to kind of tackle, is very important to kind of like go back to the drawing board and constantly be reminded of what's important, to kind of make sure that things are going to go out in a timely manner, because that's another thing that I want to kind of lead into is super long game cycles. Super long game cycles kind of slows down discoverability, and because of that, trends. There's a lot of trends that happen within 3 years, within 5 years, within 8 years, right? And it's one of the things I think developers always try to avoid, because unless you're Rockstar, where you're okay with just pumping one game out every 8 years, that's unrealistic for a lot of studios to sustain. Yeah. I would love to kind of hear your commentary about that, your kind of your observation about that in general, about the industry, and if that applies to MMO or other genres especially.
Yeah, I think games that require a ton of time, like 5 year development, 6 year development cycles, are really reserved for like that whole grand grand game that you're trying to create, this amazing, like Cyberpunk, for example, right? But for most games, I think if anything, that works against them, because it's like even within a year, the sort of the trends and the things that players enjoy and they like and how they experience games and stuff, they change, right? So if you're for a long game development cycle, like from the time you start understanding who your player audience is, and by the time you finish, you're catering towards a very, they could be very different generation, and how they experience game could be totally different. So now you have to sort of take that into mind as well. I mean, if you think about, like, I'm a Gen Xer, right? Mm-hmm. So the kind of games and the things that I know in my generation that we enjoyed and we were okay with is vastly different, like amazing, like hugely different, right? From the gamers of today and how they interact with games, because of, social media and all sorts of different ways in which, and the different types of different number of games that they have access to, right? I think, it depends on the type of game you're making. Cyberpunk, I think it's like what, six or 7 years in development, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. So, like, I mean, and that's they were trying to create a very specific masterpiece, right? And that's why they took that long to make it. So I think there's a case to be made for certain games like that, but I think it's few. Yeah. I don't think that should be the trend for most games. I think for most games, I think if anything, it's a negative to have like extremely long development cycles. And to be honest, they don't need it. From my experience, one of the major reasons for long development cycles is not that they were originally planning for these long development cycles. They usually plan for it to be really shorter, but like the delay element of things is the change in direction in the middle of, or like near the end of the release cycle, right? That comes from not putting enough time, I think, and effort in the early planning phase. That's why I generally like to have a longer, much longer prototype and pre-production phase, and a shorter sort of execution and let's finish the game phase, right? Because once you're clear on exactly what you're trying to build, building the game, just checking in, just doing your stuff, that's not hard, right? It's just trying to figure out all the little dynamics and details. That takes a lot of time, right? I, from my experience, it's always like, plan well and then just execute, right? And then put the planning time into really planning the game well.
Yeah, I think it is one of those elements that is like condoning bad behavior a lot with AAA developers. I think there are obviously geniuses, there are visionary directors that help kind of move things around, and that grants them the chance to kind of do it again, right? But in reality, at least in my experience, a lot of these studios, these visionary directors don't really know what they're doing. And so there is like a loose idea and then a lot of execution. And then when you bring it to a bunch of developers at the meeting, there's a lot of opinions, and then that sounds good. And again, it's just there's a wavering unclear direction that is easily influenced by opinions. And I think that happens with a lot of uncertainty. And that is, like you said, I totally agree why long dev cycles happen. Just poor planning. And I do like your take on like having a better pre-production. And like you said, if there is bullet point lists that you do every day that is very defined, you can really do that as long as there's, you know, no brainstorming in the middle of it. Why is there brainstorming? I mean, there might be some kind of tool discoverability that you can kind of phase out for a block of time. But outside of that, there shouldn't be any design major changes to the whole ecosystem of the game, yeah, which happens all the time. I think that's one of the biggest plague to AAA development. It's just the uncertainty. That's why when I hear games like Death Stranding, because one of my biggest fear for this gen for the PS5 and Xbox is the long dev cycles. It's a real problem. But Death Stranding, when I heard it was like Kojima doing it in 3 years with his team that he built a startup studio and he was scrambling around for an engine, he did it all in 3 years. It's like, no matter if you don't like it or not, that's an amazing feat just to put something out. And you don't hear stories like that so often. And I wonder if it's because the veteran is the team. A lot of it has to do with the team working together for a long time and trusting each other. But a lot of it's just putting your foot down and just going with what you initially set out to do. It's unfortunate, but I don't think that's going to end the trend Yeah, it's weird, but I think people just need to. I think a lot of it has to do with accountability, because I think people shift blames and we do kind of like, I think in our society, kind of glorify celebrities. So we have this, like, we put this power on this visionary director and think all this is part of the process. And I think people accept that too much, and it's causing a problem, I think. Yeah.
Like, the thing about visionary directors is that, like, some are great, but some are really just visionaries. Like, they just, their job is to create the vision, but it doesn't mean that they understand how the players feel. And this is, I think this is what you mean by, like, so sometimes their vision don't make sense.
Yeah.
And that they don't really know. They're just like expressing sort of their ideas and their creative world how they want that to sort of be expressed in the game, but they're not thinking about how the players are going to experience it. Right. And so they just see it from their perspective. And that's usually when if it's not them, they need somebody in between, like somebody that's good with systems, somebody that's good. That understands gamer and gamer psychology and, you know, sociology as a whole, to sort of create that link from that vision to how the players are going to experience things. And if they don't, then it's just like you have someone just talking and be like, don't you get it? Like, yeah.
Other people like, no. My 10-year-old has ideas.
Exactly. It's just ideas can come from anybody, right? It's nothing like amazing. They're really good at creating these kind of magical universes, right? But in a game, just because you have these ideas, it's not the same as writing a book where players are going to experience that world in through words, right? They have to experience it through an actual gameplay. So the gameplay is the words that you see in the book. So how are you going to express it in gameplay to make that sort of world that this visionary person wants to see? And I think that's the hardest part in creating games. And if anything, it's the combination of really the artists that sort of express that creative vision with some of these systems designers that create the systems that sort of best express sort of that kind of vision is where, you know, a lot of the credit sort of lies, right?
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of sign off on that is one of the popular things that have been happening. I come from the art side. is a technical art director. And that's someone that can basically build the game himself, but it'll take longer. And I respect that role a lot more because you can basically replace me if I'm not doing it fast enough for you. But I respect that because this is a person that understands the workflow, that understands the ideas, has a practicality to it, but he just needs a team to kind of help execute in a timely manner. So I respect that a lot more because it saves me a lot of time, and it truly shows me that you put a lot of thought into this, so that you're not just throwing it over the fence and praying that I figure it out for you. Like you said, an idea is a dime in a dozen, right? Everyone has one, but the execution, like game design, game development, this is not like it's a piece of entertainment, right? We're hitting deadlines to put it out there to sell. It's not a thing that we put on a wall and you know, be okay with it not no one buying it. Some games are like that, sure, but most games aren't. I would like to also ask you about this. One of the biggest things, I think it started probably mid last decade, 2015, 2016 with Houdini, right? Proceduralism was the wave of the future, and people who are onto it, especially indie developers or hobbyists, right? We're first on the bandwagon of that, and we're starting to see AAA rolling that in because it's necessary, because the biggest thing about this gen and future games are that it's still the same size team, in most cases even smaller, but the expectations are higher for quality, for everything on all fronts. And the only way to tackle that is proceduralism. So you were mentioning before about Infinite Fleet, like incorporating a lot of this to kind of match up to your previous titles, to, you know, the workflows. Can you kind of expand on that a bit of what kind of techniques you guys use to kind of help speed things up?
Yeah. So, the biggest areas in which we're using procedural generation is creating our universe and our multiple solar systems and universes. But if you were to craft every single planet, every single star, every single asteroid individually, you would need a whole bunch of, you know, artists and, you know, modelers and, you know, like people and level designers that are crafting all these experiences yourself. But what we're doing is creating a universe, a specific, like a space area where we're creating rules, basically what things should spawn next to each other, what things can't, what are the gameplay rules around certain planets and their gravity fields and this different types of anomalies and their magnetic elements and stuff, and how that affects other things in space. And, you know, so what makes sense for things to be near each other or what not, right? And then also things like terrain and things on planets, and the kind of thing that can exist depending on the type of terrain and atmosphere, right? So those are like rules within the procedural generation that we create. So they don't have to be sculpted individually by a person. And once we create these rules, it just like execute, right? And it sort of fills in the universe with all these different elements of all different possibilities and things that can exist, right? So it allows a smaller team to sort of create these giant worlds without needing a big team. Yes, it will need iterations and things, you know, as we go. Obviously we won't be able to anticipate every scenario, because of that, but, it still allows us to sort of execute bigger initiatives that, yeah, definitely a smaller team wouldn't have been able to do, without this kind of technology.
So like kind of compare to for listeners out there, like what was it like that where you have like this big team of artists kind of taking sections of worlds in previous titles or similar MMO titles that aren't using proceduralism? Like how new is this that you feel is being introduced to MMO to your genre?
So this the whole procedural aspect of things is not new. I mean, we've seen it in a lot of dungeon crawling games like Diablo and Path of Exile and things like that all the time, where levels are constantly being procedurally generated. But it's very simple. It's very basic in that it just moves walls around differently. The level itself is structured slightly differently. What we're trying to do is sort of evolve that to the next level, right? Where it's really just creating new worlds as a whole, and like creating new terrain, basically everything, new levels for players to experience, new content based on specific game rules that we set that make sense within our universe. So yeah, I wouldn't say procedural level generation is new, but the way we're evolving it, the way we're sort of taking it to the next level, is sort of more innovative than what's been out there so far.
So I always like to, I'm always magnetized to system designers within the studios, because I do see you guys as kind of like the master of the universe, setting up the rules, or at least like the middleman, where the programmer just makes no sense to me and is antisocial, but the system designer is kind of like the middleman, where I kind of understand the functionality of how this game works and is entertaining to kind of listen to. But what I like to also kind of relay to the listeners out there is that, you know, a lot of what you guys are setting things up have kind of laid down the footprint for artists. I come from an environment art background, and the way you think of setting up rules, because there are rules to how our world is and biomes and how things function, different strata of the mountains, there's certain like weather condition and behaviors that just functions in a way that makes sense for you to kind of write down on paper. We kind of been using that same way on the art only in recent years, where you guys been doing it since the beginning, to create it, to make things easier to kind of, but because, by default, right, a lot of it is interactivity. It's not a movie. So a lot of it has to do with players' input and reacting from players' input. And that is just something I feel like, at least in the artist world, has been, we're finally listening to you guys. And that's how we're building worlds on our side, because artists too are, sorry to say it, man, we don't want to build all these fantasies that you guys want, all these different like gazillion worlds. It's impossible for an artist, obviously, to tackle that. So to kind of, like you said, that there's been like a lineage of this development and proceduralism. Like what is your kind of like outlook of what the future of proceduralism is? Do you feel like the team size now, you were mentioning your team, you know, still growing, but is there a future where teams will give you smaller to make bigger things? Or I think 50 to 100 is usually a good size, just given the tools and even the evolving of these tools?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really depends. For our, what we're trying to do, I think we can grow a little bit more. Like not just in the game, like as a development team, but you know, in the marketing side of things, and you know, the other parts of our company. But it really depends. I think I wouldn't say that, you know, like 50, 60 is right for every game. Some games, you know, don't get me wrong, I don't think like procedure generation is right for every type of game. For our game, it makes sense, right? For if you're trying to make a more crafted experience where you're wanting the players to experience explicitly, like what the vision is and nothing more, then something crafted might make more sense, you know, that would take more effort. But for what we're trying to do with Infinite Fleet is, you know, we want players to direct a lot of what's going on in our universe, from the way the economy works in our game to our narrative. It's all player driven, there are real consequences of what happens in our world. So, for example, like if, let's say there is a meteor headed for Earth, right? And, you know, people don't participate and work together and destroy it, then, you know, Earth is gone for everybody, and they have to live with that, those kind of consequences. That's like a very interesting thing about our game, is that, it's like narrative, it's very player driven, and the consequences are real. It's the same thing with economy, right? Economy is going to be very player driven. We're not going to constantly trying to, keep things in tune and keep things in a way where, we're trying to control the offset of how the economy is run. If players really value a certain type of resource, and they want to create an economy around that, then that's fine, right? We want that to happen.
Yeah, definitely. One of the questions that I would love to ask you too, and kind of touching upon, it's a favorite question. I like to kind of throw this out to designers. Streaming has become a dominant force to how we design and make games now. So not only you have to try to execute your vision, but now you have to add another layer of, is this watchable every second of my design? I would love to kind of hear your thoughts about that. Has it changed the way you design your games? Is it a big factor percentage wise, small factor? Like what kind of thinking process and pre-production you have to prepare for that now that, people want to watch every second of your game, and for some games it's a buy it or just watch it type of thing.
So I don't think there is a lot of thought put into that. I know that, so when we make a PvP game, and the game is focused for player versus player, that's definitely, there is a lot of thought put into that aspect, because for a game to become an esport, it has to be entertaining to watch. That's one of the key factors to drive a game to esports. A lot of developers think esports is something that they can make for their game to happen. Like, you can't make esports. It's just the players have to want it, right? So the only thing that developers can do really is to add things like observer mode and, make the game entertaining to watch, right? Then the game has a potential to become an esport. But in our case, right now, we're focused on PvE, so player versus enemy, where later on we will be incorporating a PvP aspect, and it's the PvP part where we'll really be focused on is the PvP gameplay when players play against each other, is that interesting to watch? Right. Is it too slow and there's not a lot of action and immediate rewards as someone that's watching, or is there enough there? So it's engaging players, right? Those are metrics and things that we'll see later on. But in this case, for our case, we're really just, I wouldn't say we don't care about it, but we don't really think too much about it at this moment. We're more focused specifically on just the players that are playing, that would be playing moment to moment. How long of a cycle are they engaged in, and how likely will they be coming back after their first, second, third sessions and things like that.
And I'm going to ask you to put on your biz dev hat real quick, just to kind of talk about that. Is that ever a factor while you guys were pitching Infinite Fleet around, where streaming becomes like a point of conversation for publishers to okay or some features, or asking you to add features? Has that ever been a talking point as part of your design?
It's only, again, it's only when there's a big drive for it to become an esport. Yeah, not really in the PvE sense of things, but definitely when the publisher or investor has a real interest in that whole esports theme of things. That's when they really care about how the entertainment part of the watch experience when players are watching other streamers. Mm-hmm.
So you briefly talked about earlier in the interview about distributed work. So obviously pandemic time. You guys were, it sounds like you guys were prepared for this more than others. Can you kind of talk about your thinking process before the pandemic? Why? How has that worked for you or against you for reasons?
Yeah. Just like you mentioned, like we were doing it before the pandemic. So I was actually, I've been contacted by a few friends at Relic, after the whole pandemic and everybody started working remote, that like, how do you run things? Do you have issues? You know, all those kind of know-hows and stuff, right? So, I took the time to share that. The reason I think it's great in that it allows a studio to sort of attract some of the best talent from around the world. It also allows you to find talent a lot easier than when you're constrained to a specific region and a zone. So, those are some great things. Some of the difficulties are when you're spread out too much, I guess across multiple time zones, then it's really hard to set up meetings because, for some people, it might be like 4 o'clock in the morning. So like those are some challenges that we sort of deal with, moment to moment here and there, either through arranging special meetings with, people of that time zone. There are a lot of times when we just can't, it's just almost impossible to create, to have meetings with everybody that's working on the team, in one meeting, just because it's spread out too much. So those are some of the hard points. But then it works great for us for most things. I think the key thing is communicate often. For people that have worked in an office space before, that sort of feeling of culture that emanates from working in a game development studio, it has, I think, like somebody in the studio, whether it's in the operations or, whether it's management, they have to sort of put in that extra due diligence of making that sort of exists even when you're working remotely, because it has to be extra level of effort that has to be put in. When you're in an office space together, it just comes naturally because you're always bumping into each other, and then you're sort of sharing your game stories that you played last night or whatever. But it's a lot harder when you're working remote, because when you have a meeting, it's just specifically, okay, what are we here to talk about? You're done and then off, right? So yeah, somebody has to do that, because that's one of the things that's awesome about working in the game development industry, that sort of game development culture. So yeah, like making it not feel so much like work all the time, right?
Mm-hmm. So this is one of my last questions. I mean, this question itself can be a topic on its own, but I would love to kind of hear your thoughts and opinions about it. So one of the things that kind of snuck up on me while I was working on these big titles is the mobile industry, right? The mobile industry was like that sneaker, and in some ways, very evolved version of what the game industry should look like in terms of stability, in terms of just agileness, and it's just a beast on its own. And I feel like some design elements have come from there to games like Fortnite and the monetization part of it, at least. As a designer, I would love to kind of hear your thoughts about that, because when I talk to a designer who works on mobile, every game design has to have like a currency incentive. It's like, can people buy this or not, or that. I would love to kind of hear your thought if some of the mobile game design has ever, if you ever looked into it, is it something that you constantly look at or study to see what can be brought over to a AAA gamer experience?
So the thing I think I know that we take away from mobile game development a lot is the way they pay attention to a lot of the metrics and a lot of the data. Personally, I'm not a big fan of how majority of the mobile games work, just because they base a lot of their decisions and game the things that they introduce into the game, less about player experience, but more about how it's going to generate more profit for the studio. Right? Yeah. It's all based on revenue and engagement and how that's going to lead into more profit. Right? That's like their number one decision factor for everything, right?
Yeah.
So it's sort of like if you look at some of the bigger mobile companies, like it's they have a gigantic data analytic team that just spits out all these numbers and things that they should do, and they just follow that. What I love about mobile games is that that sort of stresses me out with like PC and console things. And I just had a recent discussion with somebody in the industry about this. It's just like how when you're making games for PC, you always have to worry about the minimum spec, right? And same with console. Like, what about the Xbox, I don't know, like 360 or like even before that? You have to worry about all that, right? Whereas like with mobile, like everybody has a mobile phone. Right. So all you need to do is make an entertaining game, and they have access to that. Right. If your mobile phone can't support this game, you won't be able to download it. Right. So it's pretty clear cut, like what you're doing. So in the technical aspect of as someone that's creating the game, it's a lot simpler. But like from a designer's perspective, the part that we do take away is trying to understand player behavior more. I think the game industry as a whole, one of the big takeaways as the whole, whether it's console or PC, have learned from mobile is that the whole data analytic element. But I don't like the way mobile uses that. I think in a lot of ways they use that to exploit gamers for profit more than allowing them for like awesome, cool player experience stuff. I think if anything, PC can probably take that analytic and use it in that kind of way, because PC games are generally more focused around that. I'm not saying all games, obviously, but PC games are more focused around sort of providing more of that epic experience than mobile games.
Mm-hmm. I definitely sign off on that for sure. It's very tech industry. All these social networks are always trying to gain your attention to kind of sell ads to you, basically. So it's not about the player experience per se. And I feel the same way. AAA goes too far about the player experience and not thinking about making a profit too. So there is a middle line there. I feel like both industries need to like have roundtables routinely to kind of figure that out, because I think there are benefits to having a playable, fun experience that makes money. I mean, that's the goal for every game, right? Why not get in a room? I feel like we figured it out, but we just don't talk to each other, which is another odd thing when I was jumping around. Like the mobile A people don't talk to AAA people. It's like completely different sectors. And then the indie people have their own corners, and it's always still separate. I hope, if anything, the podcast will bring everyone together, but like it is a pending problem, I feel, with game developers that are constantly separate. It's weird. We just don't have a hub that everyone just hangs out and trades stories, because it's everything's such a mystery. We are at the hour mark, and I want to thank you, Jason, for coming on and spilling your wisdom all over the place. This is the part of the podcast where I hand the mic over to you so that you can shout out, give attention to, and tell the good people out there what to do and what to get.
Currently at Pixelmatic, we're developing a new MMO sci-fi strategy game called Infinite Fleet, where the player assumes the role of commander of in the United Soul Federation. It's kind of like the world space force, and they've been given command over a fleet of these gigantic battle fortresses where they can upgrade, customize, and create that perfect synergistic fleet while defending humanity from the merciless and powerful enemy. And it's a lot of our economy and our narrative will be player driven, which really puts the power in the player's hands in how they sort of sculpt our universe. So if that sounds interesting, definitely check out our website, www.infinitefleet.com, where we have a whole slew of like lore and episodes of backstory that you can read ahead of time. And fundraising wise, we finished our first round of fundraising recently. We were oversold. Actually, we finished it in a day or two days.
Nice.
$3.1 million or so.
Oh, humble brag, yeah.
And we're starting our second round, and that was more for private investors. And we're starting our second round of fundraising, which will be available to the public people, and that will be available on stalker.io. That's stokr.io. And the unique thing about the way we're fundraising, unlike traditional fundraising where, you know, you buy and you get some tokens and some digital items, you get that when you participate, but for our raise, but you also get equity, right, in our company. So what's like, you don't, the thing about games like Star Citizen is, you know, you just sort of get digital items, where in our case, you actually get equity, real equity. So any kind of profit the studio itself makes, you know, we share it with the people that own this equity. So it's a new way of raising funds. And there's a lot more value in it than, you know, just enjoy the game and, you know, like it's nothing, right? You're just donating money in Kickstarters, where in our case, you're also an investor. So yeah, definitely check out stalker.io, www.infinitefleet.com.
Awesome. While everyone is captive in their homes because of the pandemic, I think people are actually looking forward to kind of own a piece of the universe. It's a nice fast time, as data shows. People are playing games like crazy. It sounds a lot of fun, man. And as always, you can find the information in the show notes, everybody, for all the links and information. Well, Jason, I want to thank you for dropping by my apartment and talking to me about the game and your thoughts and system design in general. That's it. I want to thank you for your time, and then see y'all next week.
Yeah, thanks. It was a lot of fun. Pleasure.
All right. Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you are liking the podcast, go to the Apple iTunes store and give Game Dev Unchained a 5-star rating. This will help spread the joy and love and exposure for the podcast, and we thank you very much. If you want to continue the conversation, go to our Discord, which can be found on our website, www.gamedevunchained.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at BlueChamps, BlueChamps. You want to catch these episodes live every Tuesdays and Thursdays, go to twitch.tv/blue_champs. Email me any of your concerns or questions that you want me to read aloud at the beginning of each episode at info@gamedevunchained.com. And if you want to further support us and help unlock the next feature, which is the voicemail feature, go to patreon.com/BlueChamps. This gives listeners a chance to kind of call in, leave a message for both me and the guests to answer your deepest, darkest questions and comment on your deepest, darkest secrets. Thank you, everybody.